The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. You are in the studio this evening with me, Aisha, and I have the lovely Matt with me again.
Good evening.
It's just us two tonight.
Yeah, it's a small, intimate, cozy show.
Yes. So coming up this week, we have the much anticipated Tom Weston Jones interview, which if you were listening a fortnight ago, you might have heard me do a little teaser trailer about some kind of bum double. So you will find out the answer to that tonight when we play the entirety of that interview. We're also going to give you a bit of a teaser of another interview we'll be doing in a fortnight, which is with Duncan Hands, the writer of Blackshaw's upcoming production of Black Shuck, which is a part of the WAF Festival. So you'll hear that towards the back end of the show. Matt's going to be talking a little bit about something you went and saw this week.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the Old Vic's production of The Caretaker.
Yep, so stay tuned for that. But the first thing that we always do, and Matt's got his promo back this week, is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Do you feel better that that's back now?
I always feel better. It just feels more official.
It's a bit weird when we did it without it. I didn't know what to do afterwards. I was like, okay, Matt, just do your film
Let's
review
just go
now.
Into it.
Go.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm just going to go into it this week as well.
Cool.
So let's talk about Zootropolis.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done an family animation since Inside Out.
No, we have not.
And this is a family animation about stereotyping, prejudice, and racial profiling by police.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Was not expecting that.
Yeah. As a synopsis, as an elevator pitch, I think it's pretty strong.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this is a movie about Judy Hopps, who is a bunny. Mm-hmm. She's never referred to as a rabbit. There are no rabbits in this film, only bunnies.
Okay.
Okay.
What is the significance of
There's no significance of that. It's just something weird that I picked up on, that nobody ever says rabbit. I think it's because it's a family, like, for a kid's movie, and bunny is, like, the
Sounds
cuter
better.
Word.
Yeah.
I don't know. She wants to be a police officer. That's all she's ever wanted to do. But nobody thinks that she can do it because she's just a cute, dumb bunny.
Aww.
And everybody stereotypes her as a bunny, and so she can't be a police officer. So you're starting to see where the prejudice and the stereotyping thing comes in. She gets through police academy, joins the Zootropolis police department as their very first bunny police officer, and on her very first case ends up teaming up with Nick Wilde, who is a fox, and they sort of have to get over their prejudices about each other, the prejudices about her being cute and dumb as a bunny, and the prejudices about him being sly and cunning and wily as a fox.
Okay.
And also there are animals going missing all over the city of Zootropolis, and basically, I don't want to spoil too much, but to put a long story short, suspicion ends up falling on the predators of the city because
they are predators.
Exactly. Yeah.
Uh-huh,
they're the ones with the claw. So it's this grand metaphor of the police assuming that the predators must be responsible because that it's in their DNA. They keep saying it's in their biology, it's in their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bunny cop movie. I'm not going to take credit for that because that is a joke that they make in the movie, so they're obviously very aware of what they're doing.
Yeah.
The fox, in fact, Nick Wilde, is played by Jason Bateman in probably one of the first good movie roles Jason Bateman's managed to pick out. He's been pretty good on TV, but his movie roles have historically
Terrible.
Not been great.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a good one for him, and he does well in it. In terms of sort of the plot and the style of it, they make the bunny cop gag, and it is a buddy cop thing of the cop and the Nick is a hustler and a con man, and they have to end up having to, you know, through a series of convoluted circumstances, having to team up to solve the mystery. But actually, the genre trappings of it are a bit more film noir
right.
than buddy cop, in that it starts off with a very straightforward missing persons case, and they keep stumbling into conspiracy upon conspiracy upon conspiracy, and it goes, oh, this is the thing that goes all the way to the top.
I love it.
Yeah, and a little bit of all the sort of film noir genre tropes of getting punched out and knocked out and taken to the next stage and captured by the villain and escaping and all those sorts of things. And the villain not quite being who you think it's going to be. I found it really satisfying as a mystery, and I thought it worked really well as the sort of the big metaphor of giving a younger audience a lens through which to understand that idea of prejudice and stereotyping, and even sort of giving them scripts that they can use to kind of articulate ideas that might make them feel uncomfortable, but they're a bit too young to understand.
Mm.
Like when Judy first arrives at the police department, someone calls her cute, and she sort of politely and self-effacingly explains that it's okay for bunnies to call each other cute, but it's not okay for other people to call them cute. That's creepy.
Oh, bless.
And, you know, there are gags about sort of people wanting to touch sheep's fur, which is very sort of a very clear analogue to sort of people's...
people in clubs?
Yeah, touching people in clubs, or sort of specifically touching afro hair.
Which is an urge that people
have that is kind of creepy and not okay.
Yeah, and racially not.
Yeah.
Not cool.
Yeah, so, you know, it's John Lasseter is the exec producer, because it's a Disney Animation Studios piece,
mm-hmm.
And he's the guy behind the Cars movies, and so that seems to be his kind of thing, is these universes or worlds that have the trappings of human civilization but don't have humans in them. They have cars or they have animals.
Yeah.
I've not seen the Cars movies, so I don't know whether it functions as a metaphor there, but it certainly functions as a really interesting and well thought out metaphor here.
Yeah.
And the background detail of the world is just so well thought out and detailed. It's a lot of visual gags in the background. You know, they make you laugh, but they're also ways of showing that the world has been thought out, and that this is a civilization that sort of cares about giving all the different kinds of animals, from the tiny little hamsters to the tall giraffes, like the same access to everything.
Yeah.
So, like the coffee stall at the train station is run by small animals, but it has a big tube on top that they can send the coffees up so that the giraffes can drink them, and that sort of thing. And
like, yeah.
The trains all have different sized doors for the different sizes of animals and that sort of thing. So it feels like it's very well thought through and very, very detailed.
Yeah. I can imagine the people that come up with these kind of films must just go to town on like coming up with these worlds and stuff.
Somebody's just had so much fun thinking through all this stuff.
Like,
and it is funny. It functions as humour, but it also functions, you know, it's not just a gag for the sake of a gag. It's creating a world that feels like it could work, even though it's completely bizarre.
Yeah, even though it's probably never going to work. And I think this is the thing that I've heard the most about this film. Do you think it's Disney, not Pixar?
It's Disney Animation Studios.
So I always get really confused whenever I see an animation. I always think it's going to be a Pixar, but this one is not. And I think the thing that I've heard the most about all over, mostly social media, I mean, I don't follow, you know, 13-year-olds and stuff, and which I feel like this is what this film is, that the target audience is younger people. But it's another one of those ones where older people are getting a kick out of it. And also just like the complexities of putting together something like this is really interesting. Like I read a statistic that was, I think it's maybe a bunny or a fox or like quite a furry animal in this, has got more hairs on it. And they've like individually put these hairs on this animal in this animation, and it's got more hairs than the entire cast of Frozen.
Wow.
Yeah. There's been a lot of work has gone into making the animals like super realistic.
That's animation moving on in just like 2 years, is it, since Frozen came out?
And we were talking about it as well. Like, I mean, these films take years and years to make. So when you're watching something like this, that technology is already kind of past. You know, yeah. something new is going to be coming up to make the next greatest animation film. So you're always watching something that's sort of been done in the past a little bit. But yeah, I think just some of the cool things, like I saw the sheep, what you were talking about with, you know, sort of a correlation between never touching someone's afro. But when I watched it on the little snippet that I saw on Facebook, it was just, I think, some hoofed animal touching a sheep's head and their fur. And I was like, that looks so real.
It does.
I've touched a sheep's hair. And I feel like that's exactly how I felt when I was like, it was just a weird, yeah, really weird feeling. But yeah, it looks fantastic. I'm really, really excited to see
it. Talking about the sort of the audiences and the age groups it's aimed at, it has extended Godfather and Breaking Bad references in it.
Oh my goodness.
But like, I feel like sometimes in these family movies, those references can be put in very much to like, this is to entertain the parents and it's just going to sail right over the kids' heads. But I feel like they're properly integrated into the story in this one, so like you don't have to get the movie reference. I haven't seen Breaking Bad or The Godfather, but
dear.
I know, right? but I recognize both the references, but I didn't feel like I was missing out because I
haven't
didn't,
seen yeah
because
yeah
I haven't seen them.
No.
It was just like, oh, it's appropriate here for somebody to be in this situation, so why don't we dress him up a little bit like Walter White from Breaking Bad? Rather than, we need to shoehorn an adult reference in here for the older audience.
Mm. Who voices the main character?
She's called Jennifer Goodwin. Don't know of anything else that she's been in. I don't recognise her face, so I don't know if she's primarily a voice actor person.
I've never heard of her either, and I didn't really hear much about this film until it sort of came out in the last couple of weeks, I'm going to say, maybe?
Yeah. I don't know whether it... Because it's got... two listed directors and a co-director. So Byron Howard, Rich Moore, and then Jared Bush co-directing.
Mm.
And it's got about seven people listed as with story credits, which can often mean that it's had some, that a film has had some problems if it's got that many people touching it. But it doesn't seem to, you know, often that shows when you're actually watching it. I wouldn't have said, looking at it, that it's had problems. It's also, it's got a different title in the States,
yes,
so I don't know whether it's had localization problems as well. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I think it's got a different title in a few European countries as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's a choice from from Disney.
No idea.
Or if it's just maybe there was a movie that was called whatever it's called in America.
I don't know.
Here
it's called Zootopia in the States.
One.
So
yeah.
I don't know. The only thing I could think was that it might be that in the States, they can swallow the idea that you would call somewhere like a reference to utopia, like the perfect society.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we're a bit more like, no, just call it something that states that it's a city and that's all that we'll accept. But
God damn those Americans.
Yeah. Oh, and talking about recognised voices in it, just want to mention Idris Elba as well, who is the chief of police who is a buffalo.
Oh, fantastic.
And he's basically playing the hard-ass authority figure from Pacific Rim, except as a buffalo who is the chief of police. Oh, and he shows that he's got really good comic timing in this as well, which I've not seen him show off before.
Good. You've made me want to go and see this a lot. Only because I feel like you said at the start of the review, I think the last animation we did was Inside Out. And then I saw it after you reviewed it, and I wasn't that wrapped in it. And I think it was it had a lot to do with animation with humans, and that doesn't really sit that well with me. So I'm excited to see this one because it's just animals and I love animals.
It's a recommendation from me. I think I enjoyed it.
Is it going to get up in your top five for this year, Matt? Is it too early to call?
Well, it's too early to call, yeah. I don't know. I don't know about that. We'll see.
I'm pretty disappointed that you're not talking about Batman versus Superman this week.
I still haven't seen it, and based on the reviews, we know people who've seen it, and they're basically telling me to steer clear as well. So.
Yeah, it's not going well.
I'll see it on DVD.
Yeah, I'll see it when it comes in Amazon Prime.
Yeah,
or something
like that.
Yeah, but I was talking to Matt about what he is going to be doing in a fortnight.
Yeah.
And
so I thought I'd do Eye in the Sky,
yes,
since we talked about the fact that it has a vaguely similar premise in terms of drone warfare mm-hmm. to London Has Fallen, but looks like it probably handles it a bit more adult, looks in like, a bit more of an adult way.
Yeah, maybe looks like just a better film all round. Yeah. I might just be able to put that out there.
Better people in it, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. And then I think you said maybe you've got one in mind for the future.
I mean, we've only done one superhero movie so far this year.
Mm.
I'm already booked in for Captain America Triple Bill.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Is that number three?
It is the third Captain America movie. Civil War is coming out at the end of April. So I'm booked in at the Genesis Cinema, which is my local in the East End, to see the first two, and then a midnight screening on the day of release of Civil War.
That is commitment to Captain America. Commitment that I do not have, my friend.
The first one I can take or leave. I enjoyed the second one enough that I'm quite hyped for this one.
Yeah. I don't want to leave this film review on a downer, but yesterday I found out that there is another Star Wars coming out in December.
Yep.
That makes me so upset. I just got through the whole, Star Wars stuff. You know, we really, did not talk about it on show because it doesn't sit well with me because I find it very weird.
Because it's in space.
It's mostly because it's in space, Matt. No, that's correct. But yeah, there's another one coming out in December.
I mean, the trailer looks pretty good.
Yeah.
They're calling it James Bond in the Star Wars universe.
Oh,
or possibly Ocean's 11 in the Star Wars universe. One or the other. Or both.
I'm not excited. I am excited
Determined not to be excited.
Yes, exactly. I am excited for Eye in the Sky, though. So if you want to hear Matt reviewing Eye in the Sky in a fortnight, then tune in to the Black Tarot Arts Hour. Or you can download us as a podcast, because we are a podcast on iTunes. So if you're not listening live, why wouldn't you be? But, if you've got stuff to do on Sundays, then that's fine.
If you are listening live, but you want to tell somebody else to listen to the bit that they've just missed, then tell them to subscribe to the podcast.
Exactly. If someone has just walked into your house and you're like, wow, you've just missed this bit, then you need to say, go onto iTunes and download and subscribe to the Black Tarot Arts Hour on a podcast, because that's where we are. Moving swiftly on, we are going to play you an interview now. The lovely Ellie Pitkin went along and she spoke to an actor called Tom Weston Jones, who I believe that you went to university with, Matt.
I did, as did Ellie.
Yes.
As did a few of the Blackshaw crew.
He's a Blackshaw guy. We can probably claim him as a Blackshaw guy, I would say.
We can claim we gave him his start. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Launched him to fame.
Okay. So Ellie went and she had a bit of a chat with Tom. I think she's going to talk about something that we were talking about, Matt, which is some kind of blood-related incident.
We're going to talk about a university anecdote that I think is mentioned in the interview. Yep.
So listen out for an anecdote that that Matt might be able to expand on after you hear this interview.
So, I'm Ellie, and I'm here talking quite excitedly to the wonderful Tom Weston Jones. Hello, Tom.
Hello. Hello, Ellie.
Hi. Hi. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I went to university at Royal Holloway, where, we came across each other. And I graduated in 2008.
Correct.
From Royal Holloway. I'm glad I got that one right. I studied drama there. I went to drama school in Bristol after that. And I've been working as an actor for 5 years now, after I graduated in 2010, which is scary. 6 years now, because it's 2016.
I know, horrifying,
which is
isn't
mad.
It?
It's just all flying by. And yeah, I've been working all over the place, really, in whatever I can get my hands on, but mainly in television and theatre.
Excellent. That's a good origin story.
Yeah. There's no villains or anything, though.
Not yet.
No.
There's time. So, What's a kind of quick summary of your career so far? What sort of things have you done since you graduated?
So a quick summary. The first job that I had when I graduated was an advert, actually. It was a commercial. But I probably should stop saying that about people because I want
I'm going to look it up as soon as I get home.
Oh,
what is it?
It's very embarrassing. It's just an Ulster Bank advert. But it was the first thing that I ever did. And it actually made me realise how any actors in commercials are they get treated like crap. It's really quite sad. But anyway, it was actually quite an exciting thing to do because it made me afford to move to London, which was great. And when I was here, I did a play at the Hampstead Theatre. That was the sort of first proper job I had, and that was called Enlightenment by Sheila Stevenson. And That was a great play, quite a Marmite play, really. It split people down the middle, but that's sort of the kind of thing that I quite like.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I had my first job on television, which was in Spooks, and I played Sasha Gavrik, who was this Russian character who worked for the Secret Service, the Russian Secret Service. And then after that, I did a Channel 4 series called World Without End, which was sort of a medieval epic. It was the second part of a two-book series. The first one was Pillars of the Earth, and this one was World Without End. And then the job after that was Copper, and I did that for 2 years. That was two series set in New York, filmed in Toronto, but set in New York in the 1860s. And then after that, I'm losing my track of time.
You're doing so well.
I'm losing my track of time.
Do you need me to look up your Wikipedia article?
No, I've got it. And then after that, I did a series called Not Safe for Work, which was a comedy series on Channel 4.
Very funny. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
I loved that. It was my first time doing comedy, as it were. And it was, yeah, one of my favourite jobs, really. And then after that, I did a play at the Armida, which was my first time doing Shakespeare. And that was a real challenge, but I loved it. That was doing The Merchant of Venice, and I played Bassanio. And then after that, I filmed Dickensian a few months after that. There's obviously different time, spells of time not working in between those jobs at various different lengths. But yeah, Dickensian was the last job I did, apart from a short film I did recently, which was quite fun.
And Dickensian's just finished airing on BBC.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh,
started watching it at Christmas with fam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Quite glad that the episode where we saw your naked bottom wasn't the one I watched with my family, because I enjoyed pointing out who you were and probably wouldn't have been so appropriate for that episode.
I'm amazed we got away with me getting out of the bathtub in the nud.
I know.
At 8:30. I was really surprised.
I was also very surprised, Tom.
I think everybody was.
And I looked obviously because I was watching the television, and I thought to myself, That is definitely Tom, because there was no cutaway, so there was no opportunity to swap in a double there.
No. That was, I am my own bum double.
And is that written into your contract?
It depends.
Amazing.
I don't mind showing a bum. I mean, it felt appropriate for the show. Nudity is a weird one, because you want to only do it when the time is right and the job is right and the thing's right, because when it's on film, it's forever.
Yes.
So, yeah. It was kind of a no-brainer. I've been naked on stage before, and that was the first job I ever had, and that was a strange thing, because I was only 21.
Sure.
I think I actually called my dad and said, "Dad, they've asked me to be naked on stage. What am I going to do?" He was like, "Just grow a pair and do it. It'll be fine." Grow a pair and do it. And yeah, I did it, and my parents watched it, and that was what I was
worried about. And haven't disowned you,
No, they haven't yet.
Yeah,
not yet.
Good. What's that like, though, being naked on stage? Did you have to do it a lot in rehearsal, and then by the time you got to doing it in front of an audience, it wasn't so much of a big deal?
Well, actually, the director, Ed Hall, he was quite clever, actually, because in the script, it's just he's in underwear, and he's covered in blood, and he's cut himself and stuff. It's quite a weird scene. But he felt it just wasn't really working for some reason. And then the day before we were about to do the press night, he said, "You know, let's just make it more shocking. Can you just lose the underwear?" So I didn't have to rehearse it. He just said, "Do it." And we didn't tell the other actors. So it's sort of like a reveal. The duvet, he drops the duvet that's covering him, and they see that he's naked, covered in blood. And their response was
real.
Real. Because I was just bollock naked in front of them.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a baptism of fire for a first
sort
job,
of,
isn't it?
Yeah. I'd love to say that I, you know, grabbed it, for want of a better word.
That's good, we'll leave that in.
Grabbed
that's
the bull
good.
By the horns and just went, "Yeah, I'll definitely do it." But yeah, it was a hard decision to make. Just because I'm a man doesn't mean I like being naked in front of other people.
Sure.
I don't think anybody would say that they enjoy that. Some people might.
Toddlers.
Toddlers might.
Toddlers really enjoy
it. Narcissists.
That. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a weird thing. Eventually, I didn't mind. I didn't mind at all. In a weird way, it kind of felt nice. You could sort of made me think, if I can do that, I can do anything on stage, in a way. So yeah, this is the most I've ever spoken about being naked.
Yeah, sorry, I mean, this was not actually on my list of things to ask you, so. It did remind me, though, when you said covered in blood, that when we were at uni, you played Stanley, wasn't
I
it,
did,
in
yeah.
Streetcar,
yeah.
And you actually cut yourself on
I
stage.
Did. Yeah, I've still got the cut on my thumb.
Have
there.
You?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you did sort of spray biohazardous material everywhere.
Yeah, which is what it was deemed, biohazardous waste.
Yes.
Biohazardous waste all over the stage. I cut myself on one of the boxes because I slammed the lid down on my finger stupidly. And then I just sort of waddled around the stage losing blood the entire time. And it was quite funny because I could see everyone else on stage was looking at me like they didn't really know how to say it. Because you can't save someone, you can't throw a line in going,
oh, you're bleeding.
Oh, you're bleeding.
I'll get a bandage.
In a New Orleans accent.
Yeah.
That was pretty terrible, you can tell.
That was excellent.
It slipped
Good
since
job.
Then.
It's fine, if you have another job based there, you
based
can
there,
practice.
I can work on it.
I mean, that's commitment to the role.
Mm.
Naked and bleeding.
Naked and bleeding.
So, here's a question for you. Is there, like, a role that you really want to get, whether that's something specific like Doctor Who, or if there's something, just a genre or a type of role that you really want to go for next?
I don't think there's any particular role, because I'd like to do new writing, so I don't know what that role might be. But I will do anything if it's good. I don't care about the size or scale of things. I just think as long as it's got a good pedigree and the people behind it are worth working with, then I'll do anything. I'd love to do more Shakespeare in a way. I don't necessarily think Shakespeare is my comfort zone, but that's kind of why I want to do it a bit more. But yeah, in terms of a kind of part, I think science fiction, you mentioning Doctor Who, yeah, I'm a huge fan of science fiction. So that would be another genre to jump into. I think I haven't done anything science fiction, and I'd like to do things more modern day.
Mm.
Three of the television jobs that I've had have all been, you know, period pieces. And I worry sometimes.
Are you worried that you're going to get typecast
historical face Tom? Yeah, period face. Which isn't a really great phrase.
about that. Historical face.
Historical face, yeah. Much nicer.
It's a shame Downton's finished, really, because you could have been a shoe-in there.
Exactly.
Who do you admire in the industry?
Loads of people. One of my favourite actors is Paddy Considine.
Mm.
I really love him. Just some of the old films that he did with Shane Meadows are some of my favourite films. Loads of people.
It's like asking what music do you like?
Yeah, I don't really have a favourite actor. I think Paddy Considine probably comes quite close.
Is there stuff that you've seen recently that's inspired you?
Actually, it's funny you mention it. I watched Trainwreck, which is actually just an all-out comedy, to be honest, quite a dark comedy. But I thought it was absolutely brilliant in how ridiculous it was, and how it actually I brought me to tears. Partly because I was on a plane whilst I was watching it, and I always get emotional when I fly. It's the altitude. It was just the altitude. That's what I said whilst I was wiping tears away,
sobbing
from my face.
On the person next to me.
And I absolutely loved that. There's actually a lot of films I need to catch up on. I need to go and see, so there's some inspiration to come. I also watched, a massive Tom Hardy fan, and I loved Legend. It was just so weird. It's such a weird
film. And playing two characters that are acting against each other all the time.
And the two performances are in two different styles as well. It seems to be one of the twins was just completely real, at ease, sort of like him, I imagine.
Mm.
And the other one, he just went completely the other direction. It was, really cool.
Nuts.
You don't really get... I can't think of any other opportunity an actor has had, other than Armie Hammer from Social Network to play the twins.
But have you seen Orphan Black?
Yes, I actually know Tatiana.
Do
that.
You?
She is
incredible.
She's amazing. She was in World Without End that I did years ago.
Yeah.
And we met on that, and she's so nice. Like, so hardworking and just really good. Just really, really good.
Her accents are flawless.
Yeah, absolutely. She works her ass off. I remember seeing her while she was filming it, and she was like a zombie because she was just working.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, because the amount of research you have to do for one character.
Yeah.
Let alone like six that she's playing on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So what's happening now? What's the current
Well, now
aim?
I'm just auditioning for things all over the place, really. It's pilot season at the moment, so there's just a shed load of 1-hour pilots coming out of the US, so I'm just literally auditioning for them. And I'm also writing my own film at the
moment.
Are
you?
Yeah, which I've been doing for a long time now, but it sort of feels like it's finally coming together.
Do you have a mentor for your writing?
I have a friend who I write with. I do have people who I know are writers who I will pester and prod when I think that, you know, it's above grade 9 level kindergarten writing. But yeah, it's a long work in progress, but it's something that I fill my time with when I'm not acting, because I think if you don't have something that you're passionate for, therein madness lies, basically. Like, you can have long swathes of not doing anything, and that is the biggest challenge as an actor. That is the hardest thing, just to keep yourself focused and keep yourself full of belief.
Yeah, motivated.
And motivated, yeah. And that happens, I think, with actors of all size and shape, not necessarily ones who are, you know, struggling to get their first job, or what the people who are incredibly famous go through.
Yeah,
well, ebbs and flows.
I remember Olivia Colman saying that after Broadchurch aired, no one was ringing her because they assumed she must be really busy.
And that
she wouldn't want to do any of the projects they had lined up.
Exactly.
Because she must be so busy, because she's just done Broadchurch. Yeah. And of course, filming schedules, actually, she'd filmed that series of Broadchurch
probably
a year before.
Yeah.
So there's this huge fallow period of wondering if you're ever going to work again.
Which is mental, considering that, I mean, women already have it unfairly hard enough in the industry. Mm. So for them to do that to her is ridiculous.
Yes.
It is a nonsensical industry, and a lot of it is quite confusing and infuriating, but actually I think as long as you find something that just keeps you ticking creatively, then that gives you something to
ground yourself in. Yeah, I think that's really good. What's life like on set? I'm intrigued, because I've never done any kind of film or TV anything.
It all depends on the set. It can be quite a pressure cooker, and it can sometimes be a place where people are just farting around too much, because it's so easy just to take it easy. And the waiting is the hardest part. If you've got a scene where you know you have to, you know, go somewhere with the character and you have to produce tears or, you know, whatever, anything from the spectrum that you pull from, then you just can exhaust yourself. You can really can exhaust yourself by literally just hanging out with people. And I tend to keep myself to myself and not take things for granted on set. I like, you know, getting to know everybody. But, for instance, on Dickensian, everybody was so nice. Such a nice place to work. The crew were brilliant. We filmed it in London as well, which helps, I think, in a way, because you're not away from home, therefore, wherever you are, you have to try and enjoy it. Whereas London, I live here, so it's that is kind of alleviated the
pressure.
So you
can go home every night.
You can go home every night, and you can have your own life and dip into that group of friends on your own terms, which is really nice. It's a really nice thing to do. But yeah, it was a good place.
Have you worked with anyone who's like really method and kind of isolates himself and stays in character?
Not really, no. I have once, and it's something that I don't really... I wouldn't call myself a method actor, but I do certain things that someone would say that's the method. Because we all do it in varying degrees. Mm. We all have to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. So yeah, I adopt some of those ideas, but I do it in a way that makes sure that I don't infringe on what other people are doing.
Sure.
Because I think you have to respect what other people do. You can't think that what you do is the only way.
This is a difficult one for you to answer. Mm. Tell us something unexpected about your job. Are there like weird things that have happened on set, or things that your average Joe wouldn't know goes on in the industry?
I think that there are funny moments with nude scenes, which people just sort of take for granted in a way. I mean, we've spoken about nudity a lot already.
That was nudity on the stage.
That was nudity on stage, yeah, that is different. But there's certain scenes, like sex scenes are weird, because, I mean, I'm with someone, happily with someone. So I sort of, you know, you don't need to set ground rules if the person that you're doing the scene with is in the same boat. You just both know. Sometimes it's worth just saying, like, what do you or don't you want me to do? And just approach it practically. And some people just like to go for it and forget about it. And to some degree, you kind of have to do that. But you also just want to make sure that you don't, you know, put your hand where you're not supposed to, for want of a better word.
Get a slap.
Yeah, exactly.
And it, I mean, I've all the kind of interviews I've heard from people who have sex scenes say, oh, it's very technical and it's all about, you know, the, getting the lighting right and the cameras right. Is that how it runs?
It all depends on the way that it's shot. Some scenes I've done, it's just literally all set up so you can just, you know, get your kit off and do it. But then some of them, they take time because they can be the most stylized part of the of the show or the shoot. So, yeah, that can be weird when you're inches away from someone and they just, you have to pause you and then touch you up and then do it again and again and again and again and again. And that can be quite tedious, but that's wherein, like, I don't take myself too seriously on set, and that's where I think I like working with people that take what they do very seriously but don't take themselves seriously at all, because then you can just have a laugh when you're doing something as ridiculous as pretending to kiss, or kissing, obviously, but, you know, there's, you're just trying to give an intimate moment where there's 30 people staring at you inches away.
And when you've had to do it 27 times already.
Yeah, exactly.
Who have you really enjoyed working with?
Loads of people. Tuppence Middleton, who was in Dickensian, was great to work with, and Joe Quinn as well. There's a bunch of actors who I like. Dylan Taylor, and he's a wicked actor. He's a Canadian guy. I worked with him whilst I was filming Copper. And he's someone who is sort of the same as me. He wants everything to be as perfect as it can be, but also just wants to make sure that he and everyone else is enjoying themselves while they're doing it. That's not to say that you should just fart around all day and, you know, try and have a laugh, but it's good to work somewhere where you feel like you could do anything. And I think if there's too much ego flying around, if there's too much, I don't know, like if you feel like you're walking on eggshells, then it just, you don't feel very free. And that's where I come from with it. I just like to be as sort of free as possible.
What's it like working on the comedy, Not Safe for Work? Because that's, from a viewer's point of view, like, I know nothing about it other than what, as a viewer, it looked like parts of it were improvised. It felt very fresh.
Well, yeah, some of it, actually, some of it was, but I think mainly from Sasha. Sasha Dewan, who played Danny in it, who was amazing in the show. And I think Zowie improvised some of it as well. I didn't, and I tended, I didn't want to step on the writer's toes because I just literally hadn't asked. And then towards the end of the shoot, I did it once, and they went, that was great, why haven't you done that more often? And I went, well, you didn't say. I would have loved to have done that. But yeah, it was a really great place to work, that was, because the scripts, I thought, were brilliant.
It's so tight. It was really good.
It was really slick, and all the characters had just the right amount of flaws to them.
Great neuroses going on.
Yeah, exactly. And the actors were really, really great. Anastasia, who was in it, who played Jeffries, I think she's one of the best actors that I've ever worked with.
She's pretty wonderful.
She's amazing. And just had, her character was so tragic, and she played it so perfectly and truthfully that I found myself just laughing at someone who I knew I just shouldn't be, because it was just so awful. When she's on the phone with her disabled son and he calls her to see next Tuesday, and she repeats it, and the way she did it just floored me, because it was so heartbreaking but so funny.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
It felt like very human comedy.
Which
is my favourite kind.
Yeah.
Are they going to do another series?
Sadly not. Sadly not, yeah.
I've got it on series link and everything.
I know. We all wanted to, but it's one of those things where I don't think it got the level of publicity that it needed.
That's such a shame.
Yeah, because the DC Moore, I thought, did a great job with it, as did the directors. But who knows? Stuff gets picked up. We were filming there was a similar series filming at the same time that my friend was in, and that's been picked up by Netflix now, so other things can happen. It can have a second
life. That would be great, wouldn't it, doing a Netflix series?
Yeah.
I know Tuppence Middleton was in Sense8, which I really enjoyed as well. It's so strange how the industry has changed so much in the last few years.
It's
by
crazy.
Netflix and now Amazon Prime
producing
their own such high quality shows.
And also they don't have to answer to anyone, so their shows are as gruesome or as there's as much sex. They can push the envelope so far because they're not advertising anything. People's subscriptions pay for that.
Yeah.
So
no, I've not thought about that. But you're totally right.
It means that they can just get to what they want, how they want it, and they don't have the man to answer to.
That damn man always getting in the way of creativity.
With his advertising and his, and it's that stuff.
Oh no, it's, I think it's great. And there's actually some great stuff now coming out of BBC Three now that's online only as well. I don't know if that's because they have less, I mean, BBC obviously has got a lot of constraints to work to, but the couple of dramas that have started since it went online are just cracking.
Yeah, I've heard that.
There's one called 13, which is about a girl having been abducted and just escaped.
I heard about
it's
that.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's so good. I'm totally hooked and gutted that they haven't just released it all in one go.
Because it feels normal now, doesn't
it? I know, right? I want to binge. I want to stay up all night and watch it and then not sleep.
And dream of Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. I haven't watched House of Cards yet.
It's really good.
It's on my list, it's literally really on my list. I think that's pretty much all the stuff I kind of... Oh, well, there's okay, here's a good last question.
Okay.
What is the dream? What is the big thing that you aspire to?
I'd love to be in film. I love films. It's sort of that's where my language for it all comes from. Just because I've watched, we all have, but I've really watched films and enjoyed film the most out of all the sort of forms. And it's something that I think is really mysterious. And that's also why I want to direct things as well. The great thing about acting is that I don't think anyone truly... They could probably think that they know what it is, and they think that they know how it's done. But as soon as you go, that's it, I've got it, done, then you're just, you'll sink, and you'll stagnate. And that's what's so great about it, is that it always changes. And that's what directing is to me, is that you can always discover new things to the actors that you work with, and you can try and help them, but essentially... you're always learning things. And that's why certain people just work constantly, because they're trying to constantly figure out what it is, knowing that they probably never will. But that's what the journey is. That's what the whole process is. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking to
me. That's all right. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
That was Ellie Pitkin talking to Tom Weston Jones about all his roles, and it's actually a good thing to play off of the back of playing All of Our Great Expectations, because Tom was actually just in Dickensian, which ended, I think, a couple of weeks ago.
Was it running that long?
I think so.
I wasn't following it, I'm ashamed to say, despite knowing somebody in it.
I think it ended quite recently. So that's just... I think that's the end of our Dickens... sort of foray into the, you know,
for now
maybe we'll pick it up at the end of the year. But Matt, you're going to elaborate maybe a little bit on that incident. Well, that maybe Matt had to clean up slightly.
Well, no, so on that production of Streetcar Named Desire where Tom bled all over the place, I was one of the deputy stage managers. And for people who aren't familiar with backstage hierarchy in theatre, you have the stage manager, who is the one who sits in the box and calls the show.
Mm-hmm.
The deputy stage managers sort of manage both the wings, making sure that people and props and set furniture and things are where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there.
Yeah.
And then the assistant stage managers are generally the people who actually do the moving around.
So
assistant stage managers were the ones who ended up actually having to clean up the biohazard.
Why did you have to call it that?
It wasn't us that called it that. It was the theatre manager, the sort of the tech manager for the university who ran all, you know, the faculty member who ran all of the studio spaces and things like that.
Right. It seems like a little bit of overkill to me. Just like call it blood.
He was certainly a character. Yeah. It was very in character for the character that he was to
a come character in the theatre
to come in bigging it up as biohazard rather than just please can we clean up this mess please
before someone slips on someone else's blood.
I mean, in that show there was a prop bottle to smash every show as well, so the assistant stage managers, the ASMs, were already having to sweep up a lot of broken sugar glass every interval anyway. So
add blood onto your list for
adding
your
cleaners. That onto the top of it just made it more real for them, I think.
Yeah, no, of course. I think that leads us into talking about anything. I don't know if Matt, you've ever seen a play and you've known very, very clearly that something has gone wrong. And I'd like to know, when Tom was bleeding on stage in Streetcar, did the audience notice?
Nobody that I'm aware of ever pointed it out or said, so why was he bleeding everywhere?
That's so impressive, isn't
it?
And I think, I mean, I'm more or less an audience member most of the time rather than someone who is on stage doing anything. And as an audience member, I never see anything that goes wrong unless I actually know the play inside out, and then I'll be able to go, oh, someone dropped a line or whatever. But generally, stuff can go so wrong and actors can be so cut up about it and sound guys can be cut up about it and, you know, your stage managers and stuff. But generally, audience, no idea. Blissfully unaware.
Generally, like, people dropping lines, you're not going to notice as an audience member unless you're really familiar with the play, or unless like you've got the play text in front of you and you're reading along. Generally, like, or unless the cast are particularly bad at covering it. And, you know, somebody gets a line wrong and the person that they're playing the scene with can't
work out
where they're going to. I mean, you should go and see more plays in preview if you want to see stuff going wrong.
But that makes me so anxious, though. I can't even watch my husband sometimes on stage because I'm like, oh, God, please don't forget your lines. He's not going to. I mean, he's a professional. That's his job.
Glad you have such confidence.
I do have confidence. I have to have confidence. Otherwise, I'm a withering mess in the back seat. Like, I need to, like, I can't sit in the front. I need to be, you know, at the back. But I'm always really worried, not for him, but also for other people, because I'm like, oh, don't you screw this up for anyone else around you. What if you screw this up for your co-star? Obviously, like, that's never going to happen. No. But it's very nerve-wracking.
The most I've seen go wrong was in previews for Cinderella at the Old Vic a few years ago, which was the panto that, much vaunted, because Stephen Fry wrote the play text for it, wrote the version. And because it was in previews, stuff went wrong. A big, like, piece of the set panelling just peeled off slowly and majestically throughout somebody's speech.
Oh, dear. I thought you meant, like, it just fell off onto the stage, because you can kind of style that out,
it was,
I
like,
guess.
A whole strip of stuff.
Really slow process.
Yeah. And the transformation from, like, the rags to the dress, the big sort of pre-interval reveal,
right?
The mechanism got stuck halfway.
Oh,
yeah.
Did she just keep? She was just still in rags.
They styled it out.
Okay,
they were all pros, and, you know, we'd all had our disclaimer: you have bought a ticket to previews, so don't.
Did someone
don't
come
complain.
On at the interval and say that just to make sure? See, that's I'm okay with that, like, big productions and seeing that kind of... Because that's kind of funny. I mean, you know, well, it's not funny for the people who actually have to catch the, you know, get the
you
rap
You can get away
it.
With it more at a panto as well.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bit less suspension of disbelief from the audience anyway.
Yeah. I think you were saying that... We're going to talk about the caretaker a little bit now. Were you saying that people had their phones on at the Old Vic?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most common thing to go wrong, and it's nothing to do with the cast or the crew or anything that's within their control.
No.
It's just people in the audience keep their phones on. Don't put them on. Guys, put your phones on airplane mode. Turn them off.
Yeah, it's not that
just
difficult.
Turn them off. You're not going to answer a call in the middle of the show.
Wow, yeah, not for 3 hours at caretaker, because it was 3 hours long.
So 3 hour running time, but that includes two intervals, so it's in three acts.
Right.
And it felt pretty choppy.
Mm-hmm.
It went at a good lick.
Yeah.
It's a really odd one, because the play thrives quite a lot on repetition and on people sort of coming in and going over and over the same ground with each other, or reusing the same excuses and the same lines to each other all the time. So it's a classic Harold Pinter play, for anybody who doesn't know the setup. It's all set in an attic in a very run-down house, and a guy brings a tramp home who he has rescued from a fight that he got into. And the guy seems like maybe there might be something wrong with him mentally, he might be a little bit unstable. And the tramp seems like maybe he's trying to take advantage of him.
Right.
But then the guy's brother comes into the mix, and he's a very odd person who seems to be sort of maybe gaslighting the tramp and sort of trying to make him doubt his own reality and things like that. And it becomes It's a play about sort of power relationships, mm-hmm. And who is exploiting whom,
yeah.
and taking advantage of whom, and imposing on whose hospitality,
yeah.
all these sorts of things, which is kind of interesting given that none of them are in a particularly powerful position. They're all living in this like horrible garret.
Yeah. Was it good?
So the show itself, it's not, you know, as a disclaimer, it's not my usual cup of tea. It's not the sort of show that I get really, really enthused about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird one. It's done in a very naturalistic style, but in terms of the characterization, it gets really surreal at times where, you know, it goes out of its way to try and make sure that you don't really know whether people's motivation is what it seems, or whether they're messing with other people,
right.
or what on earth is going on. And that, you know, it leaves you with those questions at the end as well.
Mm-hmm.
The performances were fantastic, I thought. Daniel Mays as the first brother, Timothy Spall as the tramp, Davis, or possibly Jenkins. And I'm afraid I've forgotten the name of the actor playing the other brother, because he's somebody that I've not seen in anything before.
Right. I looked at, actually, a promo poster for it. I might be completely off the mark here. Has one of the guys been in Harry Potter?
Timothy Spall has, yes.
Timothy Spall was
his Pettigrew.
Pettigrew, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Ah, see?
Yep.
I didn't completely.
So similarly, playing another sort of,
I see,
slightly rundown hobo-ish character.
Yeah, that's what I got from the poster. Yeah. But yeah.
George McKay is the other brother.
Okay, so it's three-hander.
Yep.
No females.
Nope.
If you want to go and see The Caretaker at the Old Vic, it is running up until the 14th of May, and you can get tickets starting at £12, which is quite reasonable.
Yep.
And it's 3 hours long, so just bear that in mind before you buy tickets.
But as I said, it does have two intervals.
It's got some breathing space there. Going swiftly from something at the Old Vic to something that Blackshaw is doing, we are doing Black Shuck as a part of WAF. We've been talking about this quite a bit, but next show we are going to be hearing from Duncan Hands, who is the writer of Black Shuck. And this is a little bit of a teaser of the interview. It's an in-conversation piece with Helen Johnson.
And with Black Shuck, it is just two people talking for a very long time. And as a writer, and as a relatively inexperienced writer, that's quite scary. You can't cheat. There's nowhere to hide, really. It's all in the words. And that, you know, sort of, I put a bit more pressure on myself this time.
Yeah. I have Googled this, therefore I know the answer, but could you please tell our listeners the title of your play and then what on earth that thing is?
Yep, the title is Black Shuck, spelt, because people won't see it, black as in the colour, and S-H-U-C-K.
Right.
And it's a sort of legend, and based in East Anglia, mostly around North Norfolk, of this demon dog, and it's the dog that became, or is very similar. I'd be amazed if the Hound of the Baskervilles wasn't based on it, and also the Grimm in Harry Potter. It's an omen. If you see the dog, then it's it's an omen of death. But there are, of course, lots of, because it's a folk myth, there are all sorts of different variations on this myth, and some of it, you know, there are actual stories of churches where the dog was seen, and there are also sort of stories of the dog being a good omen. And coming and helping, particularly sort of women in distress on their own, is one of the rather nice sort of variations of it.
Okay.
And that's that story. And the play is slightly tangentially about that. It was sort of the title. It's more of a theme that's sort of dipped into every so often, rather than the central feature of the show. The main line of the show is these two smugglers waiting for a shipment to come in on the on the North Norfolk marshes where they're waiting.
That was Duncan Hands talking to us about Black Shark and explaining a little bit about it. So hopefully that will make you want to go and come and see it with us. It's going to be playing at the Bedford in Balham from the 11th to the 19th of May. So if you jump onto blackshoreonline.com, you can follow all of the links and buy a ticket and come along. We'll be there. We'll go and see it, won't we?
Yeah, Matt? We will.
And I'd just like to point out that Duncan Hands might have one of the best voices we've ever had on the Black Shore Arts Hour.
It's very soothing, isn't it?
It's a great voice. It is a fantastic voice. If you want to hear more of Duncan talking to into your ears about Black Shark, then you can tune in a fortnight's time. We'll be playing the full interview, which I think is about 15 minutes long. So 15 minutes of that lovely man's voice.
Looking forward to that.
Yes. So that's what's happening on the next show. We're also going to be talking a little bit more about what we're doing for WAF. We're going to be doing a new writing night, which we'll give you information about. And that's pretty much it. We've nearly finished the show, Matt.
We have. So up next on Wandsworth Radio, it's the Cheese Board. Check at Wandsworth Radio on Twitter for the lyrics to this week's sing-along.
Okay.
And check at Blackshore Update on Twitter for stuff about us.
Are the Cheese Board doing a sing-along?
They are. They do.
To you about that?
They have.
Oh, wow.
They're waiting on tenterhooks in the next room.
I might hang around in the studio to hear some of that. I might sing along myself.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You might have to wait for the whole hour to get the sing-along. I don't know. I don't know when they're going to drop it.
Well, await that with much anticipation. We will be back on your radio. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast if you cannot listen live. But we will be back with you in a fortnight. Bye, guys.
Good night.